Welcome to Cross-Examining Cyber, a podcast brought to you by Herbert Smith Freehills. We explore all things cyber, including the legal, regulatory, and policy developments that impact corporate Australia. I'm Cam Whitfield, a partner at Herbert Smith Freehills and a leader of our Asia-Pac cyber practice. In this series, we'll look at the evolving cyber risk landscape in Australia by speaking to those people who are shaping the Australian legal and regulatory environment. Those who are at the front line of protecting Australian companies from cyber incidents. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Hamish Hansford. Hamish is Deputy Secretary Cyber and Infrastructure Security within Home Affairs, and at the time of recording was also the Acting National Cyber Security Coordinator. Hi, Hamish. Welcome. And where does this podcast find you?
So I'm in the heart of the parliamentary triangle in our Home Affairs headquarters, where we've got the secretary and all of the deputies, so four National Circuit and Barton in Canberra.
Before we talk about the all things sort of cyber, I'd love to hear a little bit more about your journey. We'll get personal first and then we'll get professional second. How does that sound?
Sure, that sounds great. So I've had this is my 23rd year in the public service. I've principally had a security career. I've done different things, including a stint at the Parliament House and the Crime Commission. But over the last 7 years, I've really focused on cyber and national security, headed a job in national security and law enforcement that looked at powers for intelligence agencies, powers for law enforcement, and then eventually ended up leading a division that drafted the 2020 cybersecurity strategy. Mm-hmm. And 3 years later, we developed the 2023-2030 cyber strategy. So really, I've just been focused on security generally over the last 23 odd years. And then in the last seven, cyber and national security has been my journey. And since 2016 in immigration and border protection and home affairs.
And you've held quite a number of influential positions. And I know that at times of crisis, you get called in often to fill the vacancies as well, and you have in recent times. What sort of positions have you held?
So currently, both doing my day job and the National Cybersecurity Coordinator job while it's vacant. So did that over the Christmas New Year period. And if you're a cyber criminal, that seems to be a period where you attack and people are looking for support. And there was a range of different cyber incidents over that period. Mm-hmm. So I've done that. Also, like many people, helped out during COVID in a crisis role in the national coordination mechanism. Yep. And over the last couple of years, major cyber incidents, major attributions of cyber actors, it's been a pretty busy period in cyber.
Yeah. And we waited a while, I have to say. We waited a while, but it was probably worth the wait in many respects. The cybersecurity strategy, it was consulted upon heavily. I was involved in a number of consultation processes or parts of that consultation process. For those who are listening who are not familiar with the strategy, would you mind giving us just a 101, very basic, how it's sort of structured?
Sure.
What its ambition is, because it's a very ambitious plan.
It is ambitious, but I think in order to understand where we've landed in the strategy, I'll just quickly go back. 2009, we developed our first cybersecurity strategy, which is all about the information economy, kind of a different term back then, almost 15 years ago. And then in 2016, we had a cyber strategy really focused on the cybersecurity industry, setting up an ambassador to the Australian Cybersecurity Centre. By 2020, we had a cyber strategy that was very, very heavily focused on defence and infrastructure. Mm-hmm. It's been a couple of years developing critical infrastructure laws, for example. And then by 2023, new government came in 22, had Optus and Medibank as two kind of large-scale cyber incidents with data breaches that impacted Australians. So the government really looked at, well, how do we best protect Australia and have the ambition of being a global leader by 2030? How do we actually have a cybersecurity strategy that underpins Australian prosperity? So what the strategy does is set up six cyber shields, which really go to how do we defend the nation through a holistic approach? And it's everything from cyber, small businesses, how do we actually encourage uptake of cybersecurity for small to medium businesses? How do we look at individuals? How do we look at education? Right through to consolidating our critical infrastructure and government security journey. Mm-hmm. And then I think the really kind of interesting bits in this strategy, in 2020, we put out a plan for critical tech supply chain security. And by 2023, we've actually started to co-design the standards that for Internet of Things devices. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to look at what's the area where Australians should rely on technology that's secure, and how do we develop a standard that looks at security and technology, just like other countries are doing around the world. And then world-class threat sharing and threat blocking. Our vision by 2030 is to have machine-to-machine level sharing with human curatorship, and to have an environment where there's both central sharing with the Australian Signals Directorate, but industry-to-industry sharing. And we think that's the best way to be able to protect the economy. And then for the first time, we've put our international strategy in our national strategy. So actually bringing domestic and international together. But I think finally, how do we grow our sovereign capability? So it's trying to build on the strategies that have been and set out a plan for the future.
Do you mind me asking how much of the plan, and I can see elements of it within the plan, were directly influenced by what happened when Optus and Medibank had their incidents, do you think?
So I think the creation of the National Cybersecurity Coordinator, the exercise program, a stand-up of a unit that looks at consequence management, yes, all are directly related to those incidents. Mm-hmm. And you see, as you said, bits of that in the cybersecurity strategy. We also see elements, particularly in the legislative program that governments consult you on data security as it relates to critical infrastructure. How do we make sure that we're protecting the whole infrastructure asset, mm-hmm, and then more consequence management powers? So I think you're right, there's bits in there that really relate to some of the big incidents. Yeah. But I think we've learnt a lot over the last 10, 20 incidents that we've done, and certainly I have. And in the last couple of weeks, for example, we put out a lessons learned document from the HWLE incident. And we're trying to build transparency, understanding, and just continually evolve our practice. And I think that's the basis of the Cyber Incident Review Board as well.
That publication, is that something that we can expect come out of the review board, that type of post-incident response? Is that the type of document we might expect to see?
Yeah, it's really modelled on what they're doing in Homeland Security in the US. So they've got a Cyber Incident Safety Board. It's how, yep, government and industry collaborate. They're very much focused on large-scale whole-of-economy incidents and trying to get to the root cause of that and provide lessons for the economy. So I think you're right, HWLE lessons learned is one approach the board might take, mm-hmm, but that's very much open for discussion at the moment as submissions are being sought by the public.
Can I lead with my chin a little bit here and ask a question about what's not in the plan? When the strategy, or at least the consultation part of the strategy, was released, there was a large influence or at least reference to board accountability. It was very specific. It maybe, arguably, inferred that there might be statutory changes or legislative changes relating to perhaps even directors' duties. I think what we got out of the strategy once it was published was a step back from that. In fact, I think what we've got was a commitment to consider how best to collaborate with industry design best practice principles to guide good governance, which is, there's a lot of words there to say we've probably made a decision to step back and not do anything proactive with directors. Is that the right way to sort of view that particular recommendation at this particular point in time? And we'll talk a little bit more about boards, Julian.
Yeah, I think the government in their February discussion paper of the Expert Advisory Board set out a whole range of propositions which tried to push the consultation period to the edge and say, what about this concept? What we've very much heard from industry is that directors' duties are adequate because they're based around risk. Mm. And so what we overwhelmingly heard in the over 330 submissions is, please don't add more onerous directors' duties because we think they are adequate. Actually, the thing that we should focus on is how do we support directors, how do we provide guidance, and how do we build up that information to help company directors. And AICD, Institute of Company Directors, and the Cooperative Research Centre have developed a guide during the period that we've developed the strategy, which is really useful for company directors. But I think the other kind of element that's happening with company directors, particularly those in critical infrastructure, they'll be starting to think about their own risk management plans if that applies to the critical infrastructure assets. So the boards will be more and more involved in signing off on those plans.
Yes.
And so on balance, that mix of different activities, in addition to some of the compliance action taken by ASIC, for example, what we thought was the right mix of things for company directors.
It's interesting actually, isn't it, in the critical infrastructure legislation, there's only a couple of references to the board, and I think we've discussed this before, but the significance of the board's role when it comes to the risk management program.
That's right. I mean, we've heard from security managers, people looking at risk in agencies, how do we get the board and CEO attention?
Mm.
And so we designed this program to get that attention and to get boards and CEOs involved in risk management.
Just to change tack slightly, it was always a bit bemusing to me that we might go into a potential legislative process to deal with ransomware or cyber or data extortion and not have the facts. And there are plenty of surveys out there saying X people have been attacked and X, Y paid, etc. We're seeing a proposal to introduce a mandatory no-fault, no-liability ransomware reporting obligation. Why do we even need this, Hamish? And what does it mean when we talk about no fault, no liability in that context?
Yeah, so the proposition that was in the discussion paper in February last year was, should we ban the payment of a ransom? We heard from the majority of people that the economy's not ready and that that actually would not be the best way to achieve the outcome on ransomware. So what we've gone for is, as you said, a reporting regime, because we want to do two things. Do reporting if someone has a ransomware attack or finds an extortion note. So it's reporting that fact so we can, first of all, build up an understanding of the quantum that's happening across the economy, but have an intervention point with the government to try and work out if there's a different way to respond to the incident. If there's support the government can give, if it can partner a company or an individual with an IR firm to try and resolve the incident. So that's kind of the first part of the reporting. And then the second part is, if people ultimately pay a ransom, we want to have an understanding about the quantum, how that's impacting the economy. And in order to create that transparency in the environment, that's why you've got those words of no fault, because we're trying to encourage people to report and actually destigmatize it. Because we recognize that people who have suffered a ransomware attack are victims, and people are worried about payments, they're worried about reporting. So we're trying to make sure that we build transparency in as the very first step.
I can't help but see a challenge arising, and this will always arise when you deal with these types of regimes. What does it mean to have a no-fault, no-liability regime? Where does that start to stop, of course, because we still need to have an effective series of regulations, if you like, that do their job independent of this.
Mm.
So it'll be interesting to see actually how that sort of flows through. I noticed that the consultation paper around that has left that relatively open.
Mm.
So, something to watch. One of the other things which, again, plays into this information sharing is this limited use obligation on the ASD and your role as the National Cybersecurity Coordinator. And I know many have been calling for the sort of safe harbour, protect us if we notify, and how can we be sure that the information we're providing doesn't end up elsewhere and in a place or in a way which is actually adverse to the organisation making that particular reporting or reporting to you or reporting to the ASD and the like. Can I, again, just ask the obvious question, what is driving this reporting process and why is it so important for us right now, this reporting process, so this level of information, and also the confidence, I think, on those providing that information, they can be a little bit more free. Because, and I'll add one other point, there wouldn't be a statement made by the ACC or ASD that doesn't remind us that they're not a regulator, and I know where they're trying to go with that, trying to give individuals comfort or groups, corporates comfort, but what's driving that type of proposal?
Yeah, I think what's driving it is that the government can do three things at once, and we're trying to segment what they are. So the first is with ASD and the coordinator, both of them, as you've said, are non-regulatory functions. So if you think about it, they're effectively the cyber fire trucks, both from a technical perspective in the context of ASD and managing the overall incident, including the consequences that arise in the case of the coordinator. So we want as many people to cooperate with the government to try and resolve the cyber incident. And that's what's driving the limited use around any information that's given to ASD or indeed the coordinator.
Yep.
Would be quarantined from other functions. The other kind of two functions are a regulator function. And regulators, when you think about them, if they were doing an investigation, they wouldn't use information not purely sourced. So you do an investigation and you use your powers to subpoena or obtain information through information gathering powers. The bit in the middle, though, is sometimes regulators can be involved in a response. And so what it's trying to say is they won't use that information in their enforcement and compliance role, but they might use powers to enable an effective response. And I think Part 3A of the Security of Critical Infrastructure Act is an example of how where you might deploy powers to resolve the incident, but that would, again, be kind of divorced from the limited use and the cooperation and the non-regulatory role of the ASD and the coordinator.
Mm. Look, I have to say, based on my experience with the ACSC and the team over there, they certainly do and it's improving by the day, the way in which they deal with victims of this crime, the efficacy of that, the way in which that support comes through. So, yeah, for what it's worth, my experience is that they're already getting very, very good at that. But, and we touched on this earlier, we have another body, a cyber incident review board. Sometimes I sit back and go, you know, how many different bodies do we need in this space? And I know one of the primary reasons to set up that board is to provide an assessment or details of the incident, if you like, and then also ensuring that becomes public knowledge. Now, we as lawyers are concerned, or those defending or at least representing corporates, that there are plaintiff lawyer firms buzzing around. Everyone's looking for a little bit of information. Everyone's looking for a hook. How do we strike the right balance between disclosure, transparency in relation to an incident, but not putting those companies in the firing line? And we can talk about apportioning blame and the like, but it doesn't take a rocket science to make inferences based on facts around causes and the like. So how do you think we're going to strike that right balance? And maybe it's too early in the consultation process to draw any conclusions, but I'd be interested in your view.
So particularly when it comes to the board, the experience out of the US is how do you get government and industry to collaborate together? And so that's really the principle around what are the whole of economy lessons from a cyber incident, not individually or necessarily about a company or a particular issue. And in fact, really interestingly, the US has taken the approach of looking at whole of economy vulnerabilities at the first step. But it's kind of modelled on the philosophical content of the transport safety work done by HSB and saying, actually, if you operate in the aviation sector, that there's effectively a body that builds in transparency around when things go wrong. Sure, it might have an impact on the market or on an individual company, but actually what we're trying to do is build transparency around what happened so that the lessons can be learned by others. Mm-hmm. So the extent to which companies might then use that or be used against them, that's something we're very much interested in the consultation. We're trying to really strike the right balance to say the board should have a clear mandate in legislation, a clear membership in legislation and some information gathering powers, but that's about it. And that's really what the government's testing with industry and other stakeholders to say, does that work? Is it a good model? What does it look like? What are the risks? What are the cons about doing that? And really getting a sense about where we'll land.
Thank you, Hamish. We're going to take a bit of a break now from this podcast. Part B of our cross-examination of Hamish will be released later this month. In the next episode, we'll talk about Hamish's baby, the Security of Critical Infrastructure Act. We'll chat about the proposed reforms to this act and how we're going in the active defence space. How effective are our law enforcement efforts? I'll also put Hamish on the spot and ask him if we're losing the cyber war and why, despite all the legal risks, do some government departments want to see less lawyers in the room? Less lawyers? I can't imagine a world. Thank you again, Hamish, and of course, thank you all for listening.